I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Everyone, thank you for joining us. Welcome back. I don't know if you feel the same way, but it is so wonderful when sometimes you can recall a moment in your life that had an impact on you. A moment where something happened and you clicked, you know, something in your head like a light bulb, and then you decide to change something about your life. One such moment for me was when I watched The Minimalist, the documentary on Netflix, the first time. And I have to admit, as many of you would know, I wasn't always the simplest guy. I spent a long career making a ton of money. I was at the height of my career. I was chief business officer of Google X, and Google paid well, and I had a lot of money and a lot of cars and a lot of toys and a lot of stupid things. And then I watched The Minimalist, and I will tell you that documentary, that one experience completely opened my eyes. I actually realized how much I was wasting my life, actually, not in work and in the impact, but really in how much some of those things that I allowed into my life drained me. The original documentary, The Minimalist, was Josh and Ryan, who are two very good friends who met in at fifth grade and, you know, who went through the American dream, if you want, and attempted to acquire more and more and more, and then eventually realize that there is a lot to be found in less. And their documentary was followed by a massive impact, almost a movement, if you want, that changed the lives of millions of people. On that documentary, I don't know if all people know that, TK was speaking a lot of sense. Throughout the conversation, TK was saying incredible things. And he, at the time, was the director of the Foundation for Economic Education. He's an entrepreneur, a very successful business person. And so you'd wonder why he would be a minimalist. But he has a very interesting story for that. And he joined the podcast, which is extremely successful. One of my favorite podcasts, The Minimalist Podcast, back in July 2022. So the three of them are now teaching the world that there is a better way to actually live than the capitalist consumerism that we found ourselves stuck into. Josh couldn't join us today, but hey, you know what? I should say these are my favorite two. Not really, but if Josh is not here, I might as well say that. I love Josh as well. But Ryan and TK, thank you so much for joining me. You're my heroes. I really mean that.
Oh, thank you. Pleasure. Thanks for having us. That means so much to us. Thanks so much for sharing that. That's amazing.
I don't think I'm the only one. I actually think that many, many people who have decided at least to minimize their life a little bit, because we want to talk about what is a minimalist. The image of a minimalist might actually be mixed up in a lot of people's minds. But many of those who decided to minimize their lives a little bit have probably seen your work and related to it somehow. So maybe that's a good place to start, right? The image of a minimalist is this, French style fashion home with white background and one sofa in the very, very far distance. That's not what you mean by minimalist at all, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, for Josh and I and for TK, I mean, it's about lifestyle. I remember when Josh introduced me to the word minimalism, and he introduced me to an entire community of people who called themselves minimalists. It was really a pretty diverse group of people. The two things that I noticed that they all had in common was, you know, they were all living deliberate, meaningful lives. They seemed much richer than any of the so-called rich guys I worked with in the corporate world. And they attributed their meaningful lives to this thing called minimalism. And for me, it was just some common sense stuff. I know that I had got to a point in my life where you know, I was making really good money, but I was spending even better money. And that equation just never works. And yeah. with minimalism, the idea was, hey, spend less than what you make. So that kind of resonated with me, especially back then when I was just faced with copious amounts of debt. But yeah, I mean, it's not something that we prescribe, you know, it's not something that we hand out certificates for or anything like that. It's really about living an intentional life. I mean, to put it simply, minimalism is the thing that gets us past the things so we can make room for life's most important things, which, you know, it turns out aren't things at all.
I love that.
Absolutely. So yeah, for me, I would say minimalism is about stories, not about stuff. Anytime we try to acquire something that we don't have, or we try to let go of something that we already have, we first have to unpack the stories that bind us to those pursuits or those possessions. And minimalism is all about letting go of the stories that compromise our health, our integrity, our authenticity, and creating the space for the possibilities that enter into our lives when we can take charge of the process of creating our own stories, creating stories that reflect our own preferences, our own principles, our own priorities, and so on. So I think about it in terms of one story of a man who always dreamt of living on a certain island. He lived on one island, and there was this distant island he always wanted to move to. And so he spent many years building a boat. And finally, he completed the boat, and he was able to go from one island to the next. And everywhere he went, he walked around carrying this boat. And he did that for several months.
Yeah.
And then one day someone says, hey, man, why are you always carrying that boat around? And he tells this beautiful story about how one day he had a dream and he worked so hard to achieve that dream. And this boat symbolized all the effort that he put into making it happen. And the person who was asking him says, so has the boat achieved its purpose? And he says, yeah, it got me all the way here. And he says, well, why don't you set the boat down and just enjoy your life? You didn't dream of having a boat. You dreamt of being here. The boat was merely a means to an end. And so it's not about arbitrarily getting rid of stuff in the name of following minimalism as a religion, nor is it about thinking of yourself as better than people because you have fewer things. It's about taking inventory of your life and being willing to let go of anything that weighs you down so that you can be free in the way that you define what it means to be free.
But that boat represents a memory. It represents a pride. It's a trophy. It's a moment back in time that I can look back when I'm old and frail and say, I made that boat. Look at it. It's still over there in the corner. This is why people keep it, no?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when people seek our advice on getting rid of things, it's always because of a story like that.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is when you ask people, well, hey, if this has such a powerful story behind it and it means so much to you, why even ask the question? Why not just hang on to it? And that's when they begin to talk about the weight. That's when they begin to talk about how it's not just about what it symbolizes. There's also the weight of this guilt, what it would mean to get rid of it. Or once upon a time, it symbolized something, but now it's just in the way. And one of the things we tell people is there's no universal right or wrong for getting rid of stuff. If you want to keep a sentimental item, you're totally free to do that. It's all about what brings you joy. If the joy you get out of holding on to something is what makes you free, by all means, keep it. But if the weight of that thing is greater than the joy, then you also have the permission to let it go. But you've got to define what that means for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that boat, I mean, if we're continuing with that metaphor, we want to hang on to the actual boat, as TK, you know, kind of illustrated, and we want to carry it around. And we associate that boat with the memory, which is okay. I mean, you know, things can trigger memories, but the memory is not inside that boat. The memory is inside of us. And it's too often that we don't realize this. So we hang on to every single physical possession we can so we can maintain all those memories. But sometimes, you know, just having a picture of it or just telling a story about it can trigger that same memory. And I mean, minimalism can kind of help you really determine whether or not the physical things that you have in your life are things that you actually need, or if you're clinging to them because of the memories associated with them.
One more quick thing too.
Yeah.
We've talked about this on the show before. Sometimes what minimalism does is it gives people options so that they can let go of limiting ideas about what it even means to let go. So for instance, we have a technique that we use for when it comes to like birthday cards, right? We all know what it's like to get cards for graduation, birthdays, things like that. And these cards pile up, and sometimes throwing them away feels like we're throwing the sentiments behind them away. And so one thing that we talk about as a possibility is taking a picture of the card, sending it to the person that gave it to you with a little note about what it means to you and thanking them for it. And then you can let the card go because you've taken the card, you've crystallized it by creating this digital artifact that doesn't clutter up your life, and you've shared that moment with the person who gave it to you and brought it to completion, and now you're free to let the card go. You can still keep it if you want to, but now you have an option for another way of keeping it that doesn't require the clutter. And it's all about having more options so that you can create more space for the things that really matter.
Such a beautiful idea when you think about it. I mean, I keep the cards mainly because I'm afraid my ex-girlfriend will get very mad when she realizes I threw them away. And so, you know, of course, the idea is to keep them in a safe place where I can rush to them and say, yeah, I look at it every day. There it is. But in reality, in all honesty, you know, I mean, with my work as an author, and I know you probably have the same, as a matter of fact, I get lots of books gifted to me. And in a, you know, in a very interesting way, as a bookworm, I have a very strong emotional association with the book that I read. And there was a point in my life where I basically said, but keeping it is literally killing it. In reality, if I ever want to read it again, I can always buy another copy or keep a digital copy or whatever that is. But keeping it in the corner is not just cluttering my home. It's literally denying it of its purpose, which is for it to be read by another person. And so the idea of maybe letting go of the memory for the purpose of the object that you have could also be an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Again, like we don't prescribe anything. And it's funny because books actually come up a lot. And I know TK, he's a big fan of books, and him and I look at books a little bit differently. And that's okay for me. You know, I need a few books. Like there are a couple reference books I have, a couple books that I know I'm going to read later. But I don't have that connection to books like TK does. And, you know, what minimalism kind of has helped me do and has helped TK do is like really get clear on what those things represent to us. So if I was to hold on to a library of books, it would weigh me down. And that is really where minimalism can help people. Anytime people are feeling weighed down by their stuff. For TK, he's got a library of books. He really enjoys those. That's an experience for him. Those are things that he has in his life that adds a lot of value and it does not weigh him down. And I think that that's where people often make the mistake, especially when it comes to something like minimalism, because it does sound so extreme as we start to compare ourselves to others. I know when I first got introduced to minimalism, I was looking at Colin Wright, who was this entrepreneur. He traveled to a new country every 4 months, carrying everything that he owned on his back. I think he owned like 52 things. And I'm like, oh no, do I have to own only 52 things to be a minimalist? But then I found other people like Joshua Becker, who was a 36-year-old husband and father of two with a full-time job and a car and a house in the suburbs. There's a gal named Courtney Carver, a wife and a mother to a teenage daughter living in Salt Lake City. Leo Babauta, he had six kids living in San Francisco. And what I realized is that minimalism wasn't this dogmatic formula that that I had to bring into my life. It was more about me getting control of what my priorities were, because those had really... those had just fallen by the wayside. It's interesting. Like if you would have asked me when I first started my minimalist journey, like, hey, what are your priorities? I would have talked about, you know, my health and my relationships and, you know, things that I was passionate about. But when I really looked at what I was doing with my time, when I looked at what I was doing with all my other resources, my creativity, my finances, all of that, you would see that clearly I wasn't focused on any of those things, was not even close to focusing on my health or what I was passionate about. And I think minimalism just really helped me kind of rein in and realize that my priorities, it's not what I say they are, it's what I actually do with my time.
That's so good.
I love the way that, you always keep referring back to it. It's to let go of the things that are standing of the way, in the way of you having the things that you really want, which are normally not actually things at all, right? And I think that's really, really wonderful. But let me just ask another thing about why we keep those things. We spoke about memories and things that have emotional value to them. But I have this habit of taking away 10 things out of my home every Saturday and giving them the opportunity to be in another home, right? And the idea is that this exercise literally never ends. It literally never ends. There is always 10 things to give away every Saturday. And the reason is because getting new things has become so easy. You know, it's just two clicks away and then something arrives and, you know, you buy a tool set and what you wanted was the, you know, the hacksaw, but then that had two other things in it and you go like, yeah, maybe I will keep those as well. I'll need them one day. Or, you know, you buy four screws and you want four screws for, you want three of them. And so you keep the fourth one just somewhere over there, just in case. And so from one side, I think there is the ease of acquiring things. The other side is there is that worry. It's like just in case. And then there is the tendency to hoard because, you know, why would I let it go if I already paid for it? And I think a lot of people don't realize how far this takes them into their life.
Yeah, just in cases. Those are the three most dangerous words, especially when it comes to simplifying your life, because those three words will give us permission to hold on to anything.
Anything.
I mean, just in case, I'll keep that third screwdriver just in case I lose the other two. I remember when I was first going through all my things, I had like 20 coffee mugs. I was living by myself, but you know,
is that
I had
a bad thing. I have a 20 coffee mugs. I love coffee.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with coffee mugs. It's not a judgment on the coffee mugs. For me, it was more about, I probably used three or four of them.
Yeah.
But exactly. I had this additional 15 of them just in case I had 20 guests or just in case, you know, 15 of them broke. And, you know, if I didn't ever set up some boundaries for myself, I probably would have ended up with 30 or 40 coffee mugs. Again, there's no judgment on the amount of coffee mugs. The point is that I was doing so not very intentionally. And so I was just hanging on to everything. And you know, when it comes to just in case, one of the reasons why we hold on to these items is because of that fear of missing out. Like, we don't want to miss out on having something that we might need in some hypothetical future that may or may not ever come. And we tell ourselves these stories about these hypothetical futures. It's interesting. So Josh and I, when we first started, like way back in the day, touring with our very first book, I remember we got to our very first tour stop and we are like going into the hotel. We go around, open up the trunk to like get our stuff out of the car to bring into the hotel. And our trunk is packed with like duffel bags and garment bags and all these different things for a 2-week trip. And I'm looking at Josh and I'm like, dude, we are hypocrites, man. Like, look at all of these things we brought with us for a 2-week trip. And we started to talk about it. And what we realized is we brought all these things just in case.
Exactly.
And so we asked ourselves, okay, what if we brought only what we needed and we left all the just in case items behind? Our theory was that if we absolutely needed something just in case, we could probably replace whatever that item is that we left behind. We could probably replace it for less than $20 in less than 20 minutes. And we started using that rule 13 years ago. So since then, we've really only had to use that rule, the $20 in less than 20 minutes, probably like 5, maybe 6 times. And so I'm using this example because when you hold on to something just in case, yes, you have this one item that you might need in some hypothetical future, but there are an infinite amount of other items that we don't have just in case. So this rule, we call it the 2020 rule, it has allowed us to let go of so many just in case items and has given us the freedom to travel lighter, to kind of let some of those just in case items go. I know at first it sounds like you're going to have to spend $20 every other day replacing these just in case items, but that's the beauty of it. We hardly ever have to use it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's the interesting side of this, Ryan, as well, is that when I actually really need that third screw, I never find it. So I actually go out and buy another one anyway, right? And so I might, it just feels wrong to throw it away. How do you get over that guilt?
Well, I mean, I don't really throw things away. Like, I throw them away as little as possible. So if I have something that I feel like could go to good use, but I'm not going to put it to good use, you know, my wife and I, we have a donation box that we throw things into all the time. And really, when you donate things like that, you're finding that thing, whatever it is, you're finding it a home that might actually, where it might actually get put to use. Where I know for me, if I hang on to that third screw or screwdriver, whatever it is, you're right. Like, I'm probably going to lose it or I'm never going to use it. So yeah, donations are really big in our household. But yeah, I mean, it is that mindset that we get into though, with this waste mindset. Mm-hmm. But if we let, you know, the best way to reduce your waste is to consume less, right? So I think that's step number one to reducing waste. The second thing is finding a place for those things to go where they're not going to go to waste, where they are going to get used.
Right. I think this connects, by the way, to one of the things you mentioned, the reasons why people hesitate to let go. One of those reasons is because of a story about how irresponsible I would be if I were to let this go. And you see this happen very often when it comes to the sunk cost fallacy. Well, I already spent this much money on it. And even though it's no longer useful to me, even though I don't need it, that would mean I wasted $50 or $100. And so by hanging on to the thing, I get to sell myself a story that says maybe I didn't really waste my money. But the moment I let it go, it's kind of like I'm admitting to myself that this isn't useful for me. And I'm having a confrontation with the fact that perhaps I made a choice that doesn't reflect my values, or perhaps this is something that is no longer beneficial to my life. And so I think Ryan hit the nail on the head. The way you get over that is you have to look at it not just as me letting it go, but me making it available to someone else that is going to find joy in it. I had a friend, and I talked about this on our podcast once. I had a friend who, when back in the day of like Blockbuster Video, before we had streaming, he would rent a movie. And, you know, they give you like maybe 2 days for $3 or something like that. And whenever he rented the movie, as a policy, he would always watch the movie like 3 or 4 times. And I said, do you even do this when the movie is bad? And he goes, yeah.
I paid for
it. And I said, why? And he says, to get my money's worth. And what's hilarious about the get my money's worth policy is that he's spending 2 hours each viewing subjecting himself to an aesthetic experience that he himself doesn't like. That's like about 6 to 8 hours of wasting time out of a fear of wasting money. Mm-hmm. So when we make decisions not out of a passion for fulfilling our dreams, not out of a passion for living out our values, but out of a fear of wasting money, we end up wasting our own time, our own energy, and our own priorities in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, which is worth money. It's your life, really. It's worth much more than money when you think about it. TK, I have to say, when I watched you on the documentary on the first time, there were many guests, but you were dropping some nuggets of wisdom all the time. And then every now and then your title pops up on the screen and you're all about economic education. And I'm like, why is this guy? Like, isn't economics all about making money and driving fancy cars and being, you know, in finance and so on? What got you into this at all?
Sure. Well, my favorite definition or description, rather, of economics comes from one of my colleagues at FEE, Professor Ant Davies, who says that economics is the study of what happens when our unlimited capacity for desire comes into contact with our limited abilities and resources. One of the fundamental facts of life is that we all have to deal with scarcity. None of us know everything. None of us can do everything. None of us can be everywhere at one place. And yet our desires are seemingly unlimited. The moment you satisfy one desire, a new one is born. And so economics is the study of humanity's quest to negotiate that fact, to confront that fact and deal with it. And so economics isn't just about money. It's about human action, and it's about what incentivizes human action. And when you understand economics, you not only understand money, but you understand the principles of value creation. You understand the things that get in the way of wealth, and you understand how to look at wealth in terms that are bigger than the money supply. And that has a very nice correlation with minimalism, because minimalism is about living intentionally. It's about getting to the essence of things and understanding why things matter. And that's precisely what economics does. It's not just looking at the price tags, but asking yourself questions like, where do prices come from? And why is this the price? Why do prices seem to change? And why do they seem to change in one direction pretty consistently? Or when prices drop, what is the relationship between that and innovation, disruption, supply, demand, things along those lines? And so one of the things I tell my students is that to understand economics is to not only understand yourself, but it's to understand humanity, because everything that we do in life requires us to incentivize other people to collaborate and cooperate with us to some degree, but it also requires us to understand at a systems level the principles that affect the world we live in.
That is so cool. That's such a cool definition. I know that Josh got into minimalism when he visited his departed mother's home. Ryan, you got into minimalism when Josh, you know, appeared to become a little more happier than his usual. And so you asked him why. TK, how did you get into minimalism?
So it's interesting. Minimalism for me is similar to the term motivational speaker for me. I had a student ask me just last week, shout out to the students at Edison Tech in Rochester. He said, how did you become a motivational speaker? And I go, oh, well, that's interesting, because that's a label I never use to describe
my... I'm not.
Yeah. But also, I feel no resistance or shame at all when people use that label to describe me. Mm. Because if you feel motivated when I talk, wow, what a privilege, what a gift to have said something that motivated you. All I care about is using ideas to help bring liberation to myself and others. And if I can do that in a way that makes someone feel motivated, by all means, put that label on me. Call me a motivational speaker and I'll wear it with pride. And it's the same with minimalism. I don't feel the need to define myself in terms of labels, but I also don't run from them out of fear. I'm not afraid of being seen as a minimalist, because my life is about unpacking the baggage philosophically and psychologically that prevents us from seeing our true possibilities in life. And to me, minimalism, if it's defined just in terms of stuff, well, I do a lot more thinking than just in terms of stuff. But for me, my whole life, and I don't even remember a time where this wasn't true, my whole life has always been about trying to unpack the assumptions that I have. And whenever something wouldn't work out for me, I wouldn't get involved in any sort of like unhealthy self-blame. I acknowledge that there are things outside of my control, but I always assumed that there's something that I don't know, which if I learned, could make my life a little bit simpler, a little bit more enjoyable. And maybe I don't know it for reasons that aren't my fault, but that doesn't matter. We don't need to play the blame game. How can I make my life less confusing, less anxiety-ridden, less cluttered by creating the space for more learning, by creating the space for more contemplation? And so I guess you can say I've always been a philosophical minimalist. And if you look at the role that I play on this team, I usually defer to Ryan and Josh a lot when it comes to getting into the nuts and bolts of like, what do I do with my books? What do I do with, you know, the amount of time I spend on my smartphone? And I like to go straight to the core of things psychologically and philosophically and help people unpack their baggage there. Does that make sense?
Makes a ton of sense. And it's so beautifully said. But it also inspired me to think about something, because You say you've always been a minimalist, and, you know, or a philosophical minimalist is an even more beautiful description, I would say. But it just got me thinking, because you know how over the years we've genetically modified bananas and apples and, you know, drowned everything in fertilizers and so on. And then eventually we went back and said, oh, let's eat organic, right? When in reality, before we started to do all of this, we were all eating organic all the time, you know. And in my lifetime, you know, when you think about it, in my home country where I was born in Egypt, we did not know of any of that industrialist farming until probably I was 20, maybe 25 or so, when those large bananas, you know, Egypt's bananas are smaller, they're very, very intensely sweet. And when those large bananas that are highly engineered started to show up, we were like, what is this? Is this another fruit when you think about it? Similarly, when you look at the East, and especially when you look at the lower income profile countries, People, by definition, are not cluttering their lives with things they don't need. It seems to be quite a consumerist thing. Of course, I have to say, unfortunately, in the US, that consumerism is being exported to the world in a very interesting way because of corporate quarterly cycles and the need for profit and the need for growth. I think you mentioned that, Ryan, in the documentary, that the idea that we're constantly chasing, we're constantly being told to buy things, it's not because that's what we want. It's because that's what we're told to want, isn't it? I mean, it's funny that we go full circle and go back and say, let's go organic or let's go minimalist, when that's almost the nature of how we should live.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, yeah, that's a great way to look at minimalism. It's a way to kind of help us get back to our roots, to get back to the nature. I mean, I think when you bring up these poor communities in the world, yeah, I mean, by definition of things, yes, they're not cluttering their lives, but aren't their lives cluttered with so many other things, though, with cell phones and no, advertisements? They are. In this wanting, yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, even if you know, take the things out of it, minimalism is this philosophy that kind of helps us get back to those roots, to get back to that nature. Yeah, I mean, we see, and here, at least here in the United States, we see 5,000 to 10,000 advertisements a day.
No way! Oh my God!
Yeah, and that is. It programs us, and like that those ideas, they seed in us and they create these desires that we never would have had otherwise. But yeah, it is fascinating how I've never looked at it that way, but minimalism certainly can be a tool that people can use to get back to that natural state in a way.
Yeah, so because I spend more time working with people who economically would be categorized as poor than I do working with people who maybe have too many luxury goods. Here's an aspect of minimalism that I think the philosophical side can really contribute to. So I'm just going to give you one example. One of my inner city students, we were in class in a small group and we were talking about dreams. And this is a young Black man, about 17 years old, and he states what his dream is. And his dream is to be a mechanical engineer. And I thought that was an interesting answer. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, this should be pretty easy to workshop, because usually students might say something like a rapper or an actor. And it's kind of hard, right? Because you don't want to contradict their ambition, but there's no clear, easy path for it. And so you got to be really delicate and nuanced with how you talk about it with them. But he says mechanical engineer. I'm thinking, oh, this should be pretty easy. And so I ask him, what's the hard part? And he says, the hard part is where I'm from. And I say, well, what do you mean? And he expresses to me a firm conviction that the number one reason he doesn't believe he can become a mechanical engineer is because of the neighborhood he has grown up in and that he still lives in, and because of the life of his father, who is now in jail because of a life of crime, right? And so here is someone that's having a really difficult time imagining him ever making it out of the hood and ever being able to fulfill his dream, because he has a story going on that says, I can never do what my father did not achieve. I am destined for a life in jail like my dad. I can never be bigger and better than the neighborhood I grew up in. Now, that story is not his fault. That's a story that has been imposed upon him by the reality of his harsh circumstances, by cultural elements, and so on. And in addition to that, there are aspects of that story that have some very strong sociological and economic arguments, right, that give him every reason to believe that. But when you're talking to someone like that, you don't have the luxury to sit back with a glass of wine and just say something that sounds virtuous. You've got to speak into this young man's life in a way that helps him unpack that baggage so that he can be able to create some options for himself without blaming himself for the challenging circumstances that he's in.
Correct.
And so we begin to have a conversation about what it means to have parents that live a certain way and what it does and does not say about you. We begin to have conversations about what it does and does not mean to grow up in a certain neighborhood. And we have to approach this sympathetically, understanding the things that are beyond his control, but also in a way that encourages him to believe in his possibilities, pointing him to the resources that he didn't know about, that his mentors never showed him because he doesn't have the mentors, right? And so this is just one example of how we can have baggage in the form of stories, in the form of self-defeating beliefs, in the form of self-condemnation, in the form of having people who told us you aren't anything and you'll never be anything. And that can be as powerful as the baggage that comes from having too many things.
It's so beautifully said, Ryan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know how else I could say that any more beautifully than TK just said it. But I totally agree with what he's saying here.
Yeah. So, Ryan, when you were speaking, you said 10,000 ads a day. In the documentary, you said the average American household has 300,000 items in it.
Yeah.
I fell off my seat. But then I looked around me. I mean, if you count a pen or a Sharpie as an item, I opened my drawer and there are six of them. And then you start to count those things and there are quite a few of them. But just as TK said, there are stories and beliefs that make us do that, right? Not only are we bombarded with those stories all the time in the form of advertising. Coca-Cola is going to make you happier. That phone is going to make you more better within society. It's going to get you closer to your loved ones, da, 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 da. But there are also stories within us that things or more, let's not call it things only, more in general is going to make me more, bigger, better, happier. How do you combat that?
Yeah, I know. You would think with all that stuff, we would be beside ourselves with joy, huh? Having more than 300,000 items
in our
home.
Isn't that an interesting observation?
Yeah. I mean, because from the outside looking in, especially, like, I grew up in a very poor household, and government assistance was always a thing in our house. And I thought that, you know, having all those things would bring me happiness. And I thought money was, you know, this thing that created so much discontent in our lives. And when I realized, as you know, as I got older and started to make more money, and as you realize this too, it's like you can make all the money in the world, but a bad decision is still a bad decision. It doesn't matter how much money you have. And you know, I definitely had to learn that the hard way. But you know, when it comes to those 300,000 items, I think these physical items, whether it's a third screwdriver or whether it's a second Lexus or whatever it is, these are things that seem like shortcuts to feeling fulfilled. And the problematic thing with that is that it works sometimes, barely, just for a little bit. But you know, when I was buying a new fancy new car every couple years, like that first couple months, it was great and I'm feeling good. I got a nice car and I'm enjoying my ride. But guess what? That third car payment, fourth car payment, fifth car payment, like it starts adding up and it starts to weigh on us. And then I would repeat the cycle. Okay, well now I got to go buy something else. And I think that intellectually we know that these things aren't going to make us happy. We know that money isn't going to buy happiness, but we all just want to try it out just to make sure that, you know, that's not the answer. And I mean, when it comes to those 300,000 items in our home, you know, I would posit that that's the easy thing to do, meaning the easy thing to do is to hold on to all these things, especially when we give a little bit of our money for these things, because now it's worth something to us. So we can't let that go because we paid money for that. I'll tell you one of my favorite rules that Josh and I came up with. We've got a rule book. It's 16 rules for living with less. And one of them is called the spontaneous combustion rule. And I love this rule because, like, you could take any item in your house, any of those 300,000 items, you could pick one up and you can look at, like, this coffee mug, for example. And I could say, all right, if this coffee mug, if it's spontaneously combusted, like, how would I feel about this? Would I go replace this, or would I just kind of let it go and not worry about it? Now, the answer to this is, I think we have like four mugs in this studio, maybe six. So we'd probably go replace it because we don't have very many. But that litmus test can really help us get clear on which of those 300,000 items are actually adding value to our lives. Because if you pick up that third screwdriver, I mean, Mo, if you ask yourself, if that third screwdriver spontaneously combusted, I mean, what would you do? Would you run out and replace it?
I didn't even notice.
Right, exactly.
It's quite interesting. But once again, I mean, I keep getting bombarded with people telling me, oh, but look at this one. This has a 80-watt motor and, you know, the battery will last 2.5 minutes longer. And then, you know, and you have, I love coffee, for example. And yes, I'm still, as much as I am a minimalist, I still every now and then look at those coffee machines as if I'm looking at a porn site and say, I will make the best coffee in the world with that manual machine that I can control the pressure with my own arm when I'm doing. It's like, what are you talking about? It just is crazy, really.
Yeah, I mean, there may be a benefit to a nicer coffee machine. I mean, I think about how I make coffee every morning. It's like, it's a little pour over. It's a filter. Mm-hmm. Coffee grounds, it's a little craft.
You should be ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed
I know, right?
of yourself. I'm telling you.
but that's how I really enjoy my coffee. And like when it comes to espresso, I can appreciate a good espresso, but like for me, it's that filter coffee that I really, really enjoy. So if I went out and got the nicest espresso machine out there, I might be able to make a really good espresso, but I still prefer that filter coffee. And I think the problem is we hear these stories, we hear someone say, oh, this makes the best coffee ever. And we tell ourselves that all of a sudden, like, we're not enough. We're not going to be happy unless we have the best coffee ever. And there's this like fetish that we have with perfection. We want the perfect, yes. We want the perfect version of something. And it's interesting because when you look at the word perfection, like the Latin root, perficere, it means to be fully complete. It has nothing to do with the ideal version of something. And for me, when I think about perfection, like this is the context that I try and hold. It's not a matter of, is there going to be something bigger and better and higher quality out there? Because the answer is yes, of course, there always is. And as soon as you find the best one, guess what? They're going to invent the next best one so they can get you to buy another copy of it. So instead of looking at the perfect version, the perfect coffee, my question is this complete? Is this something that satisfies my coffee desire? And the answer is yes. Like with that little, you know, $20 setup that I have with the filter. And I'm not recommending this for everyone. I'm just saying for me, I look at that. I'm like, it's a complete cup of coffee. It tastes good. I get my caffeine. I'm not embarrassed if I have to make a cup of coffee for a friend or a family member. It's still a very perfectly fine cup of coffee. But yeah, I think, you know, this philosophy has helped me come to terms with things like that. Instead of me talking myself into buying the next biggest thing, it really helps me. If anything, it helps me talk myself out of it.
Mm. Damn, I hate it when you convince me of stuff. I hate it when you do.
Oh, I'm not trying to convince you. I'm now
thinking
welcome,
of that coffee machine. Thinking of that coffee machine and telling myself, he's right. He is right. Seriously. TK, you were going to say?
I was just going to say, you know, you could think about minimalism as the philosophy of mindfulness applied to the material side of life. Because when you step back and you think about it, it's our instincts that make us human, but it's our intentionality that makes us virtuous. What is it that gives us that capacity to be creative and to create civilization? It's that ability to rise above animalistic impulse. It's that ability to rise above the instincts and to make decisions from a place of purposefulness. It's that ability to say, oh, I feel like punching that guy in the face, but I'm going to choose to respond in a different way. I feel like giving up. I feel like sleeping all day. I feel like eating solely for fun without any regard for what is healthy, but I'm going to choose something that incorporates the best elements of what feels good, but that takes me towards a future that I value in a way that I might not be able to feel right now. And one of the challenges with the kinds of things that we're talking about right now is that it's so much easier to be impulsive, right? It's so much easier to make our decisions based on what looks good, sounds good, and feels good in the now moment. And advertisers know this and they appeal to that side of us. And so one of the things I try to remind myself of is what I call the casino technique, which is there's nothing wrong with going into a casino, but you got to remember what you're getting into. When you go into a casino, there are no windows because they don't want you looking outside and thinking about the outside world. There are flashing lights, there's bright music, beautiful people, free alcohol, and all the entertainment in the world. Why? Because everything that's happening in the casino is designed to keep you in the casino so that you can keep gambling all of your money, right? And so in order to play the casino game effectively, you have to decide what it's going to be before you walk in. Nothing wrong with going into the casino, but you got to say, all right, what's my number? Because I know when I get inside, I'm going to feel like I got the hot hand, right? Because I'm as subject to that illusion as anybody else. What am I comfortable losing? $20? $200? You name it. You know where you're at financially. No right or wrong about it. What can you afford? And that's the price of fun. You go into the casino, and when you hit that number, you stop and you get out. And that's just the ticket price that you paid for a fun time. And minimalism is about having that attitude with your purchases. Nothing wrong with upgrading your espresso maker. Nothing wrong with getting a new car, but are you getting it because you were minding your own business, living your life, and then somebody shoved something in front of your eyes and they did a little dance and you were captured by the siren song of the latest commercial promising you happiness? Or did you deliberately look in that direction because you made the decision to create a certain kind of life and then you went after it and made the proper choices? That's the difference there.
Wisdom, absolute wisdom. Do you think it's only because we're chasing happiness, or also because we're sort of, I mean, Ryan said it was perfect comes from being complete. And I think advertising is constantly telling us that we're not enough. Is there a bit of that in it as well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, happiness is like, I don't know, it's like it's a drug in a lot of ways. Like it's something that I spent most of my life chasing. And arguably, I would get it every once in a while, but it's so ephemeral. It's so fleeting that once you have a taste of it and it's gone, you just, again, like a drug, you just want more and more of it. And there's nothing wrong with happiness. Chasing the happiness, that is where it can become detrimental and can really create the opposite of happiness. I mean, for me now, it's not about trying to live at this constant peak state of happiness. It's about really figuring out what my priorities are. And I talked about that a little bit earlier. But the thing is when our short-term actions, when they align with those priorities, when they align with our long-term values, when they align with our beliefs, then, you know, we can start to shift from that chase of happiness to this state of living a meaningful life. And the beautiful part of living a meaningful life is that happiness is this byproduct that will happen. But when happiness is the goal, it's almost like the closer we get, the further it is out of reach. So yeah, happiness is we could probably just do a whole podcast on happiness and what that means.
I do that all the time. It's my whole life, basically.
Yeah.
But my definition differs slightly, Ryan. So I define that fleeting joy more around dopamine, around the reward hormone, around being rewarded by something fun, possessions, pleasure, and so on. Happiness itself is a lot more about this calm and peaceful contentment, to be okay with what you have rather than seek more to give you that rush. And in biology, that feeling comes with serotonin. It basically is more of a calmer. It's a hormone that's telling you, hey, by the way, life is great as it is. It's okay as it is. You really don't need another coffee machine, Mo, to feel happier, right? It's actually quite an interesting, I mean, I support what you're saying completely. It's that fleeting bit that comes from dopamine, comes from I'm buying a new car and then I feel a little bit rewarded. And then 2 months later, I start to go like, I need another one to feel rewarded. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think what you're talking about, and I think where our thoughts are intersecting here is really when it comes down to that feeling of excitement. Like that's where that
excitement,
that's yeah. When we get that feel, when that dopamine hits us, we get that feeling of excitement. And I think that we confuse happiness with excitement. And yeah, I mean, we could sit here and talk about the definition of happiness. I agree, like contentment is probably a much more mild version of happiness. But isn't it interesting how even contentment for me can almost be demotivating? Because if I'm too content, you know, I don't want to ride that edge of creativity, that spark of like learning something new. So for me, I mean, even sometimes contentment can be almost a paralyzing thing. yeah, happiness is it's really fascinating. What do you think about happiness, TK?
So I think the problem of consumerism to me is more about our relationship to fear rather than happiness in isolation from that. So if you think about like how we're biologically hardwired, for instance, we are incentivized for the sake of our own survival to pay more attention to things that are potentially negative, right? So if you hear that rustle in the bushes, you are more likely to survive if you infer the probability of a tiger or some kind of danger than if you're just casual and cool about everything. And marketers know this and they prey on this. They don't create these instincts. They leverage these instincts. So if I'm writing copy, for instance, and I want to write an article about marriage, I can title it in two ways. And you tell me which one people are more likely to click on. The first article is 7 ways to make your spouse happier. Oh, that's nice and positive. But if we're keeping it real, that's boring. Nobody's going to read that article. 7 reasons your spouse is probably cheating on you right now. Everybody's clicking on that, right? Wow. Because there's something about us that responds that, 7 mistakes you're making that you don't even know you're making. Mm. Compare that to 7 habits of successful people. You're not reading that article, man, but you're clicking on that other one. And we see this playing out every day on social media. What are we clicking on? What's grabbing our attention? And so what marketers are really good at doing is leveraging that instinct by saying, hey, you don't want to end up being like this guy over here, do you? You don't want to end up feeling lonely and being a loser, do you? Hey, no problem. Buy this product right here and you'll be good.
Man.
And they're very smart to not do it explicitly, because it's much more powerful to make something look stupid than it is to prove that it actually is stupid. It's much more powerful to make something look cool than to prove that it actually is cool. Because the moment you try to prove something, you're engaging people logically and the defenses are up. They're going to analyze it. But when you appeal to the imagination and you simply show them their life as it is now and you make it look stupid, they'll be afraid of it, you know? And so I think we're more likely to embrace stories of fear than stories of faith. And that plays a big role in our patterns of consumption. Here's one other thing as well. I don't think it's merely the case that advertisers create a sense of inadequacy. Certainly they appeal to that. But one thing about stories is that it has to resonate with something going on inside of you in order for it to really work, right? You can't tell a story that's just too unbelievable for people. It's got to connect to something, some real fear, some real concern. And I think most of us simply have not been taught that we're lovable as we are, that we're worthy as we are. And look, Mo, I'm telling you right now, please don't go quote me on social media when I say this, because they will eat me alive for daring to say something as obvious and cheesy as and inspirational as you are lovable right now. You are worthy right now, because everybody's going to say, nobody needs to know that. That's obvious. Any 6-year-old can know that. And then I say, go talk to the 6-year-olds, man.
Exactly.
They get it early. They get a hold of the idea that they are unworthy very early. And for most of us, we make our decisions about how we're going to defend ourselves against this cold world, given the fact of our unworthiness. We make those decisions very early on. And so when they tell us, hey, you're never going to be anything, they're appealing to these fears that we embraced a long time ago.
That is so, but it's almost unethical what you're saying. I mean, when you really think about it, to constantly torment people with silliness, really, for people to buy whatever your product is in a selfish way that makes you your quarter, but that's basically it. It's actually quite I think anyone with any wisdom at all should become very aware and very alert to all of this. My wonderful ex-wife used to always say, if someone's advertising something to me, that basically means it's not good enough without the advertising for me to buy it. Okay, so she would become very suspicious of things that are heavily advertised to her on a daily basis. I want to close with a couple of quick questions. I actually think this is a very, very valuable conversation, and I would encourage my listeners to go listen to it again and to listen to the rest of your work. Look at the three of us. We're three dudes in 3 black t-shirts. Okay. Mm-hmm. Where I think when it comes to fear, especially if you look at me, I'm an older dude, so I need to do better to appeal for the opposite sex and to have my wonderful girlfriend still be feel proud of me and so on. That's simplicity.
Hey, you look good to me, Mo.
It's not going to work, you think? Why is it that some of us are so comfortable? I basically feel this is amazing. And why are others so desperate to wear brands, labels, almost as if they are owned by Cartier or, you know, Louis Vuitton or whatever? Why? Why does that happen to people?
I think it's easier to pick a brand to represent you than it is for you to represent yourself. And whoa. I know for me, I thought...
Bombshell right there. Say that again. Yeah. It's easier to pick a brand to represent you than it is to represent yourself. I love that.
Yeah, and it's like, I wear what I wear because, you know, black is slimming. And like, this is what I feel good at.
Yes,
you know,
I agree.
I mean, it's not about making a statement. It's not about... It's not common. Like my sister, she was like, is this commentary on like... minimalism and you're a blank canvas? And I'm like, I never looked at it that way. I'm like, but I guess it could be. But it's funny how people read into, you know, certain things. But for me, it has, you know, there is nothing deeper than the fact that like I put on a black t-shirt, I look good in it and I feel good in it. And it's a lot less decisions that I have to make each day if I get up and I know exactly what I'm going to wear. But you know, if there's one message that we really try to get out there and for people to really understand, is it's that whole like love people and use things because the opposite never works. And really what that means is that you are complete. And TK was alluding to it earlier. You are complete at who you are in an empty room. And like from there, you get to decide what you want to bring into your life to maybe add a little bit of additional joy. But when it comes to my clothing, like it doesn't matter what I wear. Like I really like who I am, and the clothes that I wear doesn't represent who I am as a person. It just, you know, makes me look slimming when I wear black. So yeah. Unfortunately, I think that we look towards these external things. We feel incomplete. We feel like we're not enough, and then we tell ourselves, oh, if we get that certain logo, if we spend that certain amount on a handbag or whatever it is, well, that's going to make us feel complete. And it's the exact opposite.
Never does. Never really does. Well, I will have to say this has been wonderful. I'm a little fanboy cheering in the crowds. I really appreciate the change that you have done to my life. And I really hope that some of that wonderful joy, by the way, I also love how much friendship is always there in your show and how you play off each other. And it's just a wonderful expression of humans in the simplest form of connection, really enjoying life without all of the extra stuff. TK, I have to admit, I love you joining. You bring so much value and so much wisdom, and you're so well spoken, so well thought in everything that you share. I really appreciate you guys, and I love Josh, so give him my regards and a big hug from a big fan. And I really am very grateful that you joined me today.
Oh, Mo, thank you so much. And you're right, TK is very wise. He's got all the good words.
Stop it.
He is wise. I was going to call him Yoda halfway through, and then I said,
Behave,
Mo, behave, don't say that.
Yeah, we call him Yoda. I can get behind that.
I'm not ready yet, man. Hopefully, give me another 30 years, and let me meditate a little bit more, and we'll see where I'm at.
Exactly, and a lightsaber. So you know, just train a little bit with that. Yeah, and everyone listening, I really, really appreciate that you give me the chance to meet my heroes. When you listen to this podcast, you get me to spend time with people that really matter to me, to have wonderful conversations. This one is one that is more simple in its appearance than the actual depth that is in it. So I would urge you to go back and listen to those words again. I urge you to go to the Minimalist podcast. Incredibly valuable. I urge you to watch the documentary, to buy the books. These guys are on a mission to make a difference, and they're very, very good at making a difference. Whatever it is that you're doing in your life, do it with purpose, do it with intention. Try to do the things that bring you joy. Try to give yourself the time instead of worrying about the money. Because as I always say in this podcast, time is the only asset that you will run out of sooner or later. Doesn't matter how busy you are this week, find a tiny bit of time to slow down and reconsider. I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.